Whitney Terrell's third novel, The Good Lieutenant, is a soldier's tale from Iraq that looks back to the Kansas base of Fort Riley. As a writer, Terrell was twice embedded with the military and has written nonfiction about the war for The Washington Post and Slate magazine. Impressed by the men and women serving, it dawned on him the female soldier really hasn't appeared in American fiction. Here's why he needed to remedy that.
Women who have fought in this war have changed the way the military works and the way that people think about the military, and they're going to change the way that this country thinks about leadership.
Find out about Whitney Terrell's memorable character, Lieutenant Emma Fowler, and the influence of real women soldiers on his 2016 novel, The Good Lieutenant, now out in paperback and on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Whitney Terrell's first two novels, The Huntsman and The King of Kings County, were set in his hometown of Kansas City in different eras, revealing stories about race and class in this western Missouri border town. Both made best of lists in 2001 and 2005, so fans and students of Whitney Terrell, who teaches creative writing at UMKC, have been looking forward to his next novel. For the June 2016 kickoff of his new book tour, Rainy Day Books hosted him at the Unity Temple on the Plaza, and he brought in Major Stacy Moore, one of the influential women soldiers he met at Fort Riley, to share stories about the making of his third novel, The Good Lieutenant, in this interview by Kansas City Public Library Director Crosby Kemper III.
This novel is a very exciting novel. It's a character study. It's a love story, actually, as well. To me, as someone who's never been in the middle of it, it felt like war. The book is propulsive. And for a fiction writer, I think that's an extraordinary talent.
Physical writing is physical writing. You're always using the same skills that you would use to describe a fly fisherman as you would use to describe somebody who's engaged in combat. If you know the terrain and you can imagine it and you know what can and can't happen, it's just part of my training as a writer.
Before we get into the novel itself, tell us a little bit about being embedded in Iraq. And you were, in fact, were embedded twice, is that right?
Yeah, 2006 and 2010. It was very difficult to get embeds, and a lot of the news organizations were nervous about sending reporters over there who weren't staff, which I was not. I'm a novelist. And so I ended up embedding with an engineering trade publication.
Really?
Yes, because I knew a guy there, and all you needed was a letter from somebody. And this guy had gone on 5 embeds already for this engineering trade publication. So I went as a representative and then came back and wrote for the Washington Post.
Right. What kind of a unit were you embedded with? Did you see actual combat?
In the sense of participate? I mean, no. I was embedded with a company of combat engineers, and they were part of the 1st Division, 22nd Infantry, and their job was to drive around and look for IEDs, basically. And they had some fancy equipment to do it that was relatively new at the time, these things called RG-31s, which I'm going to read about later. These were early prototypes of MRAPs that we now use instead of Humvees. And so they were heavily armored, and the idea was basically to drive around and look for things that might look like a buried bomb. And then if you saw it, then you got up real close to it to find out whether it was. And there was actually one truck that had it's called a Buffalo, that had an arm that came out and would, what they called, interrogate the bomb, which basically is like mess around with it until
it blows up.
Blew up, yeah.
Yeah.
So they were trying to get intel on who was making them, how they were being made. So that was the job that these soldiers had. It was obviously very stressful. I fortunately was never involved in an IED attack, and I'm very happy that I wasn't. The closest that ever happened to me once, we went out on a mission. The first couple, 3 hours were fine. We didn't really find much. And then we stopped at this small patrol base, which is very much like what I call Camp Fortitude in the novel. And the guys were like, you know, we think you've had enough for today. It's time for you to go back. So they sent me back in a little small convoy of 3 Humvees, and they went on with their mission. 10 minutes later, they were hit. And I think that they knew that they were going to go down an area where they probably had some good intelligence. There had been an IED in place, and they just wanted to get me out, which I was very appreciative of. I'm happy to interview people about those things and find out what it's like rather than experience it personally. Fortunately, they weren't hurt. Just the blasting cap went off on the ID and not the entire bomb.
And that was the first time, 2006?
That was in 2006. 2006 right, 2000, was much worse than 2010.
In 2010, after the surge, but we're starting to leave Iraq at that point.
Yeah, I went to report on our withdrawal. And I was very anti-war in terms of the Iraq war at the beginning in 2003. I didn't think we should go. That's my opinion. However, in 2010, by the time we had spent so much time there, I was, I have to say, incredibly impressed and amazed by the work that had been done by the men and women that I embedded with, who some of them were on their third or fourth tour. And I was at Balad, which is a large base in the center of Iraq. Took a long road trip all the way up near Mosul. Totally safe, no IEDs. I mean, you couldn't drive a half an hour without getting hit in 2006. And so we had achieved incredible gains in that period of time. I wrote about that. It's in Slate magazine, so you can go find that article if you'd like.
So you have these two tours embedded, and you decide to write a war novel.
Yeah.
And you do something that's unique in the history of war novels. Your central character, who's very involved in this war, is a woman. And so I was thinking about recent war novels, and there are women characters, and there are women soldiers, and of course in the journalistic reports on Iraq and Afghanistan, but I can't think of a war novel in which the central warrior, and she is a warrior, is a woman. Tell me a little bit about your decision to do that.
That was an instinctive decision that I made way back before I was ever embedded. It's hard to rationally figure out exactly why I made that decision, but I knew, and I was reading enough press to know that women were going to be very important in this war in a way that had never been true before. I thought that in and of itself was fascinating and interesting. And my intuitive guess would be that they would have a different perspective on this conflict than your typical guy. One of the things you're trying to do every time you're writing what's literary fiction is to make it new. You have to write something that isn't like anything else that's been written before. And damn it, I think I did it this time. But maybe that was one of the reasons that led to a lot of the choices in the book. And I knew this was different and interesting. But that original instinct was helpful.
Well, it certainly makes the novel very complex. I will say you absolutely convinced me that Emma Fowler, the Lieutenant Fowler, who's the main character, is as much a warrior as anybody else in the history of war fiction. But on the other hand, you also make her very much different from the guys.
Yeah. Stacy and I, we've talked a lot about this. You know, one of the things that I intuited and then started asking different consultants, women who are veterans, to help me with, Stacy started working with me sort of in the latter part of the book, but early on, Angela Fiddle and a number of other women who I both met in Iraq and then in the States, you know, sort of get a picture of what was this like. Now, my character, M, is not based on a person, but one of the things that I learned was that the things that you have to think about and figure out how to do if you're going to lead a platoon of guys as a woman are more complicated, you know, banter, learning how to use humor. In other words, learn how to run a locker room, in essence.
Right.
And you don't get a lot of practice of that unless you're spending a lot of time with the guys in a locker room.
Did he get this right, Major Moore?
I remain impressed with how close he came. That's why I really enjoy the book. I think that the complexity that you add to Emma's character and that dynamic that you have to develop with your soldiers, it's not something that's immediate. But then again, she's not dramatically different than other warriors in that when you're a leader, you have to figure out how to interact with your folks, no matter what your background is. So you're always coming from a different place than your soldiers are. But I do think that it's easier if your experiences are common, and if you're leading primarily a male platoon like Emma was, her experiences were so different, she had to find that way to connect. And I think you portrayed how she came to do that very well.
One of the things that Stacy's talking about is that any lieutenant who's coming out of college, like you did, mm-hmm. right, is already different than the enlisted right. men who he or she is going to have to deal with. So adding the gender thing makes it just that much more complicated. But there always is that sort of resistance to an incoming lieutenant.
There is a moment at which she feels she has her first military success, and it's in a Cracker Barrel in Junction City.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a lot of Kansas, by the way, in this novel, because it starts out in Iraq, but the latter half of the novel takes place in Kansas. Do women have to fight for acceptance as an officer with enlisted men? And are there moments when you get control of that situation? Are you able to depend on the command structure and everybody knows that regardless of your sex, your gender, you know, what you're wearing at the time, you're in charge?
I think it's a little bit of both. There's certainly that underlying structure. Your rank only gets you so far, really, especially when you're a brand new lieutenant, because you don't know anything. But I think that the Cracker Barrel scene of the book is common. There is a constant proving yourself when you first come into the Army as a leader, simply because you have to prove to your soldiers that you know what you're doing, because no matter where you are in the world, you could be called at an instant to go somewhere to wage war, and that's the Army's job. So you have got to build absolute confidence in your soldiers that you are to be trusted in a situation where their lives are going to be in danger.
Women have now been significantly in combat. Has that changed the view of the average male soldier? Is it easier now?
Absolutely. I think that when I first came into the Army, there were a lot of older attitudes. People had not worked as much with females, enlisted or as officers. And I think that now our male counterparts who've grown up with us in the Army see what we can do. There is a level of trust that just wasn't there before. And now most of the barriers, I think, are down with men of my generation and younger. Of course, there's still some folks that have antiquated views, but they're reaching retirement age and the Army's just transforming like the culture.
Slowly weeding out those guys.
Stacy's like, it's just the old guys. I may disagree with you some on that particular point.
So to shift gears a little bit, there's a passage that Whitney wants to read.
All you need to know is this is told from Emma's point of view. It references an RG-31, which I talked about earlier, and it mentions Pulowski, who is her boyfriend, who's gone away during this period of time. They're in Iraq. I'm changing all the curse words, by the way. The RG-31 was a specialized mine-clearing vehicle that the U.S. government had purchased from the South Africans for more than $500,000 a pop. There was a 50 cal on the roof with a flared steel cowling around it, but its most important features, according to Colonel Secourt's PowerPoints, were the extra-wide, specially armored windows that would allow their soldiers to search for the culprits in the Muthana bombing without having to dismount. To Fowler, it seemed the kind of strategy Pulowski would have liked. Separation, distance, I'm not going to get involved. She was also curious how, given all those windows, this RG's grill had become embedded in the mud wall of a canal off Route Serenade, 100 meters from the main road. Nice, said Jimenez. Man, you'd think for the money they'd have some airbags in these things. Or a TV, said Dykstra. Huh? Nice flat screen. Screw the TV, man, Beale said. They need to get about 450 cals in this baby. Show the Hodges how we party. The RG's rear bumper was propped up on the near side of the canal, and Beale dropped beneath the chassis, searched for wires, then chinned himself up into the RG's cab, pants V'd with sweat, burrs cockling his pockets. Shut the hell up, Beale, Dykstra said. What? Jimenez gets to do jokes on airbags and I can't say anything, Beale said. What's that, a cultural thing? It's a shut the hell up thing, Dykstra said. Guys, Fowler said, and that ended it. What she paid attention to instead, what she sensed flowing alongside her anger and her impotence, calming it, easing it, compensating for it, were the motions of her platoon as they dispersed. She kept track of them like a melody. Waldorf across the canal to the northeast, Dykstra opposite him to the northwest, Jimenez behind them to the south, Crawford guarding the road, each of them concentrating his focus on the trees and grass and bean fields that stretched out from the RG on all sides. Even Beale, who, jerk or not, she kept as close to her as possible, seemed to have things under control inside the RG. It was her first recovery mission since Pulowski had left, and she was happy to be away from the maintenance bay and her desk. Her platoon moved exactly as they'd practiced, just exactly according to the basic, simple rules for foot patrols that she herself had learned back in the woods around Fort Hays State. Post security in all four ordinal directions, follow your team leader, do not speak. Not as good as sex, but definitely better than GoldenEye, or answering emails all day. So she noticed and secretly approved and reminded herself to congratulate the small hiss that Waldorf made across the ditch and the response from Dykstra, which was to slowly, as if he'd sprung a leak, deflate himself into a prone position amid the thick, bushy grass, each and every considered moment a redemption for the emptiness and confusion that had shamed and overtaken all of them, Fowler included, since they'd packed Fredrickson's and Arthur's body parts up at the intersection to be involved in battle in a proper way. I got something. She could hear Beale banging around excitedly inside the RG. There's somebody down along the canal to the north, he said. Canals were bad places for people to be, generally. Canals, especially dry ones, were where people hid to detonate IEDs. How far away is he? 100 meters. He's coming our direction, Lieutenant. Fowler was trying to reimagine why an Iraqi would walk toward a patrol of U.S. soldiers down an empty canal, not hidden enough for an ambush, but not in the open enough to show he came in peace. It did not fit into any known categories of behavior, or at least no category she'd been introduced to yet. "Want me to take him?" Beale said. "No, I want this mother alive," she said. "He's going to be here soon," Beale said, after some delay. "Don't shoot," Fowler hissed, climbing up on the roof of the truck. There was something wrong with the whole setup. From the height of the RG's roof, she could see the guy down in the ditch, a male, maybe 25. He wore gray dress slacks with an elastic waistband, and he was thin, and his tan leather shoes were delicately pointed. She got her binoculars out and scanned the far side of the canal. There was a tree line about 100 meters out, a house behind it. "Everybody down in the canal," she said. She got the glasses up. This time she saw movement, a filtering sensation behind the trees. She called to Beale through the opening in the RG's roof where the gunner would have stood. "Get around the bend," she said. "All of you, go down the canal and get around the bend." Beale swung out the door and dropped, running. The first shot was an RPG. Fowler saw a white puff of smoke and then heard the bad, sizzling sound, and she ducked her head behind the turret flanging. It hit the bank beside the RG. Dirt rained over her head. She got up, got the binoculars out again. "Three guys," she said. "One's in a blue shirt. Two of them are in dish dashes." A second puff of smoke. This RPG flared high and right, way off course, into the bean field behind them. She didn't even duck for that weak stuff. "All right, that's it for the rockets," she said. "They're going to run. They're going to run. Shoot them, Wally. You can engage. Use the canal for cover." The RG was tilting slowly underneath her. She had to keep leaning to the right to keep the glasses straight. Beale was yelling at her, but she deleted this. "I got the pickup," she shouted. "They're in a white pickup heading south. Call that in. Right now. Call that in." And she dropped the glasses, and the canal came back, and the roof of the RG was tilting. The thing was rolling over, and she thought, "This is easy." And she ran up the back of the sloping roof in a crouch and jumped off the back. Or it would have been easy, except for the big antenna she bumped going off. And it rotated her a little in the air and slowed her down just enough that she hit the edge of the canal, left shoulder first.
Whitney Terrell, reading from The Good Lieutenant for New Letters on the Air at Unity Temple on the Plaza, where he's joined by Major Stacy Moore with interviewer Crosby Kemper III.
How many years did it take you to write this book?
I probably imagined it for the first time 10 years ago in the winter of 2007 when I came back from Iraq and was done writing for the Post.
And it reads brilliantly, as I said, propulsive. And I think this is a brilliant stroke. You've written it backwards. And so explain, you know, if you want to explain that, you don't have to explain that. We can force them to read
it. No, I'll totally explain it.
You will figure this out within a few pages.
You understood it, right?
I did, but it took me a few minutes to pick up that it was backwards.
Yeah, writing the book forward didn't work. I mean, I worked on it for 6 years and it didn't work. And I was like, okay, I'm going to throw this whole thing away. And I've gotten down to the last 40 pages of the book and everything else that I'd hacked away. I'm just like, maybe I could just make this a short story, which is the ultimate surrender. And and it wouldn't even become a short story because the ending was too narrow. It felt too deterministic about how Emma's life ended up to end the story there. But I asked myself that question, why isn't it good as a short story? And the answer was because there's no sense of moving outward like a novel should have. I had misplaced some papers. My office was a wreck. And so there's papers everywhere. And I shuffled a bunch of papers. And what I was doing just in this OCD way, just reading through it over and over again, imagining that some new idea would come to me. And I got some stuff out of order. And I saw a scene that happened earlier in the book after those first 40 pages. And I thought, wait a minute, if I go backwards, it doesn't have to end here. This could be the beginning. And then I could solve the problem of having to deal with the opening part that I thought was boring. My editor said, I just want you to get to the last 100 pages. I couldn't do it. Hey, but if I go backwards, we'll start with the last 100 pages. Then I'll figure out the rest later. The characters, they're in quite a difficult situation when the book chronologically ends. But because the book moves away from that ending, we see them grow, become more complex, have character arcs, back to their original sort of selves before they went to Iraq. That changed everything. The structure of this book was the whole key to it for me.
I think it's brilliantly done because I think it raises questions about where the character of your principal characters comes from. As you go back further and further, you go back to Fort Riley where they're training, you go back to her relationship with her brother, which becomes a big question mark hanging over the...
Well, it ended up, what it does is it ended up making the scenes at Fort Riley a lot more interesting for me. So the part where Stacy, where Major Moore comes into this is that I had written through all the stuff that I already had written about Iraq, right? I got through those 100 pages backward, which involved a lot of work. You can't just reverse it. You got to do things. I'm like, okay, suddenly all these characters are coming alive that are referenced in Iraq. Oh, her brother's going to have to come alive. I'm going to have to write him. And this stuff that I talk about happening when they were training, I'm going to have those scenes, right? And I actually had done very little reporting on what life was like on a base. And that was how she and I met, was that I called up Fort Riley. I'm like, I got to write a end of a book that's set there. Can I walk around and ask some questions? And then we met. Do you remember that day that we met?
I do. They'd just come around asking if I knew anyone who had been a female lieutenant in Iraq involved with like transportation or support. And I was like, oh, that's me. I gave some other suggestions, but you just turned up in my office and we ended up talking forever. Like, I don't know.
We had a very long conversation. You told me several stories that are in the book. There's
shackles.
Yeah, the shackles. Just picture this scene when the novelist walks into this office in Fort Riley and sits down and says, okay, so say you had a character who was a senior officer to you, a guy, and he was going to be a jerk, and you were deploying. What would happen? You want to tell that story?
Shackles are really important to getting your gear out to port. If your truck doesn't have 4 or 6 or however many shackles it needs, you can't put it on the rail, you can't put it on the boat, you are a mission failure to deploy. It's a big problem. Everyone plays this game of stealing the other unit's shackles. And there's a scene where Emma does that. Her platoon has to round this stuff up. And it's happened to me almost every time I've deployed. So I just think it's indicative of kind of the hijinks that go on right before you have to leave to get somewhere.
You're the only person who ever answers that question. Everyone else looks at me and goes, I got to talk to my superior officer. And, you know? So I felt like, oh my God, thank goodness I've found the right person to talk to about this. Those scenes that happen at Fort Riley seem much more important than they would have if they'd opened the book. By the time you get there, you should really care about how Pulaski, her boyfriend, deals with her brother and what her relationship with her brother is like, because you've seen how it has caused her to make certain decisions that happen.
Responsibility and accountability seem to be a major ongoing question that every individual reader will probably make up their own minds about, but you investigate it and complicate it as the book winds through Kansas, because you have this, what goes on in Iraq, and then you have the background in Kansas, and she's actually a Kansas girl. Right?
Yeah, she grows up in Junction City.
And she's known as Family Values Fowler, yeah. And that's sort of her trap.
The way that I conceived her originally was that she would be this very rules-oriented person, and who wanted to be good, and who wanted only to be good. And then she would change drastically. That's not a good recipe, really, for leading people, to be perfectly honest. But that's where she would start from, and she needed to move from there. Now, one of the other benefits of turning the book around is that you meet her when she's a hell of a lot more interesting at the end of the book, you know, and you're moving back to see her become sort of more naive and more innocent. So I had to find a way to sort of give her a name and make that part of her. The reason that I chose The Good Lieutenant was I knew that I wanted to write from the very beginning, a book about a good person who the readers could morally identify with, who makes a series of decisions that the readers would morally identify with and say, oh, that's a good decision, that makes sense, this is what you had to do, and ends up, despite that good moral structure and series of good decisions, in a morally compromised position. And I feel like Iraq was a place where that could very easily happen.
So a big part of the book is, you use a phrase in the book to describe the war and the army in the war. You call it Homer Simpson nihilism. And so there's this encounter of Family Values Fowler with Homer Simpson nihilism, and Pulaski, who's kind of on the side of Homer Simpson nihilism, he says at one point, you have to control your environment. It's the first step towards clarity of mind. And she says, I hope not.
One of the things that was cool about hanging out with a battalion of soldiers was realizing, oh, well, this is just like America. Everybody has a different opinion about something, right? You can find all kinds of political opinions within the Army. There's not a uniform, homogeneous, like, oh, I'm just always going to vote for this party, and I'm only going to have this opinion. And so realizing that the soldiers are, in fact, drawn from the world that I know made it possible to have varied characters. And you have to have ethical conflict in a novel, and Pulaski has one ethic that's very different than Fowler's ethic, and they argue about that and learn from each other as the book goes along. Does that seem fair? In terms of the breadth of opinion that you find in a normal battalion?
No, I absolutely agree with that. Yeah. I think that's one of the strengths, too, is you were able to show this myriad of different people and how their views on their situation, the war in general, how that influenced their behaviors. And I think that's another benefit of having the book go backwards is you see the results of their action and then you understand their motivation as you peel it back. And I really like that about the book.
It is a good part of the military that you're not supposed to have a political opinion about the conflict that you're involved in. But what I noticed was that among themselves, soldiers have political conversations all the time, just like anyone else would. And many of the times that I spent when I was in Iraq sitting out back of the little trailers that we had all kinds of interesting conversations and the freedom to sort of have Pulowski have those sort of off-center views. Well, it was funny to me, but also it seemed real.
Well, it also makes for a great tension between them, and the book is in part a love story about the two of them.
It's definitely a love story.
Very different characters, and you describe her in a kind of 360-degree way because you're inside her head, you have her views of the world, and then you have Pulowski and other characters describing their views of her. You never quite get that same thing with Pulowski. He's a kind of a mystery man through the whole thing, which gives some interest and depth to their relationship. It's never quite clear what he's up to.
He's frightened of committing to her at a certain point in the book because he's worried that she's in danger and he doesn't want to be involved with somebody who might get hurt. And his job does not put him regularly in harm's way. And of course, that is totally possible at a big base. Camp Tolerance is what I call the base in the book, but I was at Camp Liberty. There was 40,000 people there. There were a lot of people who never went outside the wire and never would. And so Pulowski was one of those guys, right? And so he's in a relationship with a woman who is going on patrol outside the wire on a frequent basis, and that is a source of tension between them. The reason I had there be a love affair, not only because it's a good narrative thing, is that I noticed that there was a lot of dating going on at Camp Liberty when I was there, right? I think it was an underreported amount of dating and sex going on. Would that be unfair to say, or are you bound by oath to not really divulge the truth behind? Come on.
No,
No one here will tell.
No, I think that people in the military are human. Human beings crave relationships.
Yeah.
And so those kinds of things happen. It's technically not allowed for us to be having sexual relationships with one another while we're deployed, but we're all human beings.
Right.
And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
You did make Pulowski a lieutenant and Lieutenant Fowler a lieutenant, so they're
equal. That's not a breach. Which is something that Stacy, actually, I didn't know that, and she explained that to me. That's allowed.
So you don't put them in danger that way. I do want to say that I got to the end of the novel, and there is an epilogue at the end that reverses the reversal a little bit. I finished it, and then I had to go back and read the first chapter again because the characters became so complex, her character in particular. I don't think there's one way to look at her character because she's a woman, she does this.
No, you're right. I didn't want to do that.
I think she's one of the most interesting characters in contemporary American fiction. It's an extraordinary work of imagination.
Thank you, Crosby. That's really nice. Meanwhile, I'll be taking up a collection for Stacy to come with me on my entire tour. Thank you very much for coming. It's nice to see you all.
New Letters writer-in-residence Whitney Terrell talking about his third novel, The Good Lieutenant, in front of a Rainy Day Books audience at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Interviewed by Kansas City Public Library Director Crosby Kemper III, their 2016 conversation also included Major Stacy Moore, whose stories helped inspire the novel published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux and now out in paperback. For links, visit newletters.org, a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was produced with help from Nick Shea, Katie Taylor, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.